Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and I've got my mother, Caroline Kilburn, on the other end of the line. Mom?
Oh, boy, yeah.
How are you today?
I'm good. I'm pretty good, yeah. And this is an amazing book, I tell you. It really is.
Well, who do we have today?
Today we have Gary Kelly. And Gary is, I got this thing here. Okay, he grew up mostly in Algona, Iowa, so he's a local boy. And a town that historically had its own experience with, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this right, Dakotas, but survived. He earned a degree in art from the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls, where his studio is today. His career as a graphic designer rapidly evolved into one of illustration, painting, drawing, and visual storytelling. Elected to the New York Society of Illustrators Hall of Fame, he has won 30 medals from their annual juried exhibitions. He has illustrated over 30 picture books for readers of all ages, including in 2014, The Harlem Hellfighters, one of New York Times finalists for Picture Book of the Year. Moon of the Snowbird is his first true graphic novel, and it is amazing. It really is. I don't know how many times I read it.
Moon of the Snow Blind. I just wanted to make sure.
Oh, no. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I wasn't going to interrupt you with that.
Sorry about that.
So, welcome to Writer's Voices, Gary.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So, what does this mean? This is your first true graphic novel. Do you have some false graphic novels?
No, I guess by that phrase, I meant this is the first one I ever finished. I have started some on my own. This was not an assignment given by Ice Cube Press. That's the printer, the publisher of the novel. But I have a friend that has published with them before, a professor here at UNI. And I thought, well, if I'm going to finish this graphic novel, I think I could get it printed and out there through Ice Cube Press down in North Liberty, Iowa. And he's done a lot of books, Steve Simkin.
Oh,
yes,
yeah.
Yes, he has. We've had a number of his authors on Writer's Voices.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, my friend that connected me with Steve is Scott Cowalty. He did Brother's Blood. He wrote that novel and Ice Cube Press printed that. It's another bit of a much more recent Iowa history about a dark, it's not a picture book, but it's a dark murder story from up here near where I live in Cedar Falls.
Wow. So tell us a little bit of what The Moon of the Snowblind is about.
Well, one thing that, when I was growing up, I was attracted to history and Native American culture and a lot of the old West. And my uncle that taught me to draw, Gene Kelly, had a lot of books in his house, which was not far from where I was growing up, and in Algona. Some of those books kind of got me attracted to the history, to the stories, the culture of the Native Americans. Of course, we called them Indians all the time back then, but that's what really pulled me into this. And I knew when it's an interesting story. It's a dark story, but it's interesting, and I think it's some of the more dramatic Iowa history that I've ever been acquainted with. But but I knew that it's hardly ever been told from both sides, you know.
Right.
As I wrote on the first page of the graphic novel, sort of two sides to every story, because I did not want to tell it purely from the settlers, Abby Gardner's family's side of the story. I wanted to start the story with some background and then finish it the same way with the, you know, what's happened to the Dakota Indians that the Sioux Indians that were living in that part of Iowa back in those years.
You know, that part of our history is always going to be problematic to think about, I think, because on the one hand, particularly like with the Spirit Lake Massacre, a lot of women and children and even, you know, men who weren't really trying to harm the natives that they found, but they were taking their land. And if someone came in and took your house and you shot them, you would be considered justified in a way in doing, you know, if someone just came in and said, you know, kicked you off and we have this like stand your ground and so forth. But the fact that the natives, when they tried to stand their ground, were considered savages and when they were just defending their homes, and yet what they did was brutal.
They did that to each other too when they had conflicts between the the Sioux and the Crow or the Sioux and some other Cheyenne, other tribes that were in their region. Let me just read you a couple of the first a quote from the beginning of the book that kind of laid down the backstory, and I wanted people to familiarize themselves with this before they get into the story itself. And I've been studying this for a long time, and not this specific story, but this history. And there's a quote: "The war was brought upon us by followers of the Great White Father." Who came to take our land? Okay, that's a quote. I opened my book with that quote. The first line of it actually is, "The war did not spring up here in our land. The war was brought upon us by followers of the Great White Father," and so that's the over. That's the massive part of the story. I mean, obviously, you can't justify what Inkpaduta's warriors did. You know, killing so many young people and men, women, children, and then taking some captives, and some of them died as well. And Abby survived, of course, but that doesn't really justify it. I don't think her family was totally, against a Native American culture. But at the same time, Inkpaduta didn't know that. And what I opened it with, the story that I first learned, thanks to my uncle, was Inkpaduta's relative, and I'm not sure from history whether it was a brother or a cousin, but Sitaman Dota was actually that the thing that attracted me to the story initially, when I was a lot younger, you know, when I was probably growing up, maybe a teenager. The thing that started this story for me, and I never forgot it, was the murder of Sitaman Dota. He was the cousin or the half brother, according to my book, so it must be the research, half brother of Inkpaduta, and he was murdered by a trapper down near Humboldt, Iowa, and then stuffed under the ice in a frozen creek, and the trapper also murdered some of Sitaman Dota's family, I mean women and children, and that's not ever spoken about later on in the book, and that's not the specific reason probably that the Spirit Lake Massacre happened, but it's part of the backstory.
it's part of why Inkpaduta and his warriors felt threatened and wanted to strike back. And I don't know. It's such a like I said. It's there's no good guys really in this story.
Well, you know, and then of course he tried to get the justice, the white man's justice, with the trial, but they didn't even consider his.
Yeah. It's a dark story on both sides, and and I mean there are a lot darker stories for the Dakota side or the Native American side if you go to Wounded Knee or somewhere like that in South Dakota, and. Or you realize that Sitting Bull, who Inkpaduta actually had a relationship with later in life, Sitting Bull was murdered by Indian police that were working for the white man. He hadn't done anything, and everybody's heard, I think, of Sitting Bull.
Yeah.
Well, he had a relationship with Inkpaduta, and he was murdered when he was an old man. And By Indian police who were working for the white man, and he had not because he was doing anything wrong. He wasn't right. Fighting. He was on a reservation. And
he was highly respected by the Indians,
yeah,
wasn't he?
He was an icon, absolutely.
Uh huh. Yeah, that's possibly why.
But it's a dark story. There's no doubt about it. And I would feel bad for both sides. I mean, Abby was, Abby endured a lot. And she got through it. She got through it, and one of her sisters did, too.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the family did not.
Now, Gary, in your bio, it says that Algona had its own experience with Inkpaduta.
Yeah, that's probably where I first really
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, there was a cabin out near where Call State Park is, just south of Algona, just near the Des Moines River, probably half a mile south of the city limits, a lot of woods, and hills back there. And when I was a kid growing up, I heard the story of what happened out there to a family. The Inkpaduta and his people stopped there, I think probably a year or so before Spirit Lake, maybe when they were on their way up to the Iowa Lakes, moving from Clear Lake. They demanded some food and some things from a settler's cabin there, near Algona, and Algona was not a town yet. They were it was founded in 1854, and this was probably 1855 or 56 that this happened, but not many cabins. But they kind of tried to force their way into this cabin, and the settlers that were ready for them, they had weapons, and they were going to stand up to them, and they physically threw them out of the cabin, and they saved their cabin, and they saved their lives probably, and nobody was killed. No, there was no fight. The Inkpaduta and his band just left, and then a year or two later, the Spirit Lake Massacre happened. So I suppose, maybe it wouldn't have been in Algona there, Iowa, if it would have happened like it did in Spirit Lake. The town would have never happened, maybe. I don't know.
Reading your book, it really made me kind of amazed that people would bring families out into this wilderness. Like, what? Wow.
Yeah.
So you wrote Moon of the Snowblind we'll talk about the structure of the book a little bit, how it's various moon phases. What was behind that? What was the, you know, why, how did you come, how did you get the idea to do that, and what were you trying to convey with that?
Well, originally I thought, and it's been, this, it, books have been published before called The Spirit Lake Massacre. Of course, there's a lot of them, a fair number of them out there, but, and I researched a lot of them for this book, but when I realized that the moon of the snowblind is what the Sioux or the Dakota Indians called the month of March. That was their month. That, every month had a name like that for them. Every month had a different name, and March just happened to be the moon of the snowblind. You know, in their language, the moon is a month. That's because the moon changes in a month. And I, for some reason, when I was about almost finished with the story and ready to get it published, it just kind of jumped out and grabbed me that that title would probably be a little more fascinating, I thought. And as long as I could put Spirit Lake in the middle of the O and the word snow on the cover, that would get maybe Iowa people at least maybe a little bit of, you know, of adjusted to figuring out, oh, maybe, yeah, this is the Spirit Lake Massacre, maybe. So that's why I did it that way. But I just thought it was a more dramatic title.
It's a great title, but had you, were you using that as your, like, chapter headings from the beginning? Or did you go back and add that later?
No, no. When I decided to tell it by, you know, 12 or... Actually, there are probably 14 or 15 chapters. I haven't counted them specifically, but there are all of the months. And, like, it starts in June of 1856 with the moon of the strawberries, and then it goes from month to month to month. July, the moon of red cherries. August, the moon when cherries turn black. Those things all fascinated me just because I've September, the moon when calves grow hair. Those things fascinated me because it's part of the interpretation of the language, and I wanted to keep telling every or naming every month in the language of the Dakotas, not in English.
And how did you find that information?
Oh, I have a ton of books on that kind of history, and I don't know specifically which book it was, but I have been, you know, addicted to those books for decades now, since I was a little kid, you know, and that information I've always had in the back of my mind. It didn't just pop up. The fact that they named their months when I did this book, I had known that for a long time, but I'd never thought of using it as a title until I was almost finished with the story, you know, and decided I was going to call it the Dakotas, you know, version of the title, not the English version.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Gary Kelly, author and illustrator of Moon of the Snowblind. Is this, do you usually write both text and pictures for the books you've published, or are you usually doing just the illustrations?
That's a good question. No, I've never completely written and had, well, maybe one or two of my picture books have had mostly my words, but I never considered myself more of a writer or equally skilled writer compared to being a drawer, painter, illustrator. The pictures were always the thing for me. But I read a number of versions of the Spirit Lake Massacre, and I wasn't going to just grab one of those and make pictures to go along with it. I could use the same pictures I would use for, you know, somebody else's story in English about it if I wanted to, but I didn't want to do it that way. I wanted to tell it the way I had learned it, and I wanted to tell it, like I said, from both sides, from the native side and from the settler side. And so I was fortunate, like I said, when I discovered, went from my research over the years that March, the month of March, when the massacre happened, was what the Dakotas called the Moon of the Snowblind. And I just thought that would be a much more dramatic title and maybe a little more interesting, maybe a little more seductive title than the Spirit Lake Massacre, because that there are a lot of books that have been titled that.
Why do you think writers have returned to that story so many times?
Oh, I think it's a lot of it has to do with Iowa history, and most of the I would assume most of the writers were Iowans. I tried to read McKinley Cantor's. He's obviously an iconic. He was an iconic writer. He had a 1962 version of it called Spirit Lake. And that was a big, fat book. I mean, it was thick. And I tried to read it years ago, and I couldn't get that far into it. So that one was never finished. I've on the back page, I have all my source books published. And it's quite a range of, one book that really surprised me when I was into the graphic novel project, maybe a couple of years into it, let's say. I don't know what year that would have been now, but it's a while back. I was in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I was at the Native American Museum there. That stuff still attracts me, of course. And I came across a book in their bookstore called Inkpaduta, Dakota Leader. And I thought, wow, somebody wrote an entire biography of Inkpaduta, who was such a, he was not a hero to most white people. He was a nasty guy to them. And an author named Paul Beck had written that and published it from through the University of Oklahoma Press in the year 2008. And I thought, wow, now this is going to tell the story. It's not going to be totally about the Spirit Lake Massacre and Inkpaduta. It's going to be about his life. And that really, bumped me up. I mean, as far as having a lot of drama to tell my story visually with. And I'm just, I was shocked that I found a biography of Inkpaduta. And it's a high-quality book.
Well, it's fascinating to me that you are able to tell this really complex story in so few words. Of course, the pictures carry a lot of the weight. I would imagine that one of the kind of most difficult things about a project like this is deciding what needs to be drawn. How do you go about that?
Well, I'd have to say, for me, it's not difficult. It's totally motivating, and that's what I absolutely love to do. Is interpret words with a picture, and as an illustrator, I mean, I do paintings too. I've had gallery shows and things like that where they're paintings, and they're more about the image than they are about a story behind the image. But for the most part, I love doing illustration, no matter whether it's for my own books or somebody else's books or other assignments. When I can read something and then decide how I want to tell that story with pictures, tell it visually. That's what I'm addicted to. That I love that challenge. And obviously, Moon of the Snowblind, Spirit Lake is full of the options for doing pictures. For me, it was, you know, once, especially when I got into the total research and figured out, came up on a lot of side stories, backstories, you know, other opinions, things like that. I mean, one thing that would probably be a good example of that was, I don't know, maybe it's halfway through the book. I put a little, almost a, not a sidebar chapter, but a little side story in there concerning the town of Smithland, Iowa. And that's its own kind of little chapter in the book, in the middle of the book. And I had never really, I hadn't heard of Smithland, Iowa. It's south, it's southeast of Sioux City a little ways, the town of Sioux City, and on sort of the eastern side of the Lus Hills out there. And I realized when I saw that story that had a lot to do with the motivation for what Ink Vedute and his Sioux did in Spirit Lake, is what happened to him in Smithland. And I had never heard that part of the Spirit Lake Massacre until I got into that research, discovered that, and then found some chapters in history books that actually talked about that story. And I think the Ink Vedute biography was part of that for sure, but that was what sort of did it for Ink Vedute, I think. He and his his band, his not the whole tribe, but his band of Dakotas, would spend their winters down near Smithland, Iowa. And that, like I said, that's southeast of Sioux City a little ways. Actually, when I discovered that part of the story, and it definitely fascinated me.
Gary, would you like to read that part? Could you read the words of that part to us from the book?
Well, if I can get it open here without putting the phone down. It's the month of February 1857, the moon of dark red calves, Smithland, Iowa. And again, I'd never heard of that town. I went out to visit it, not in the winter, but in the fall to see where it is. And here's what I found. 100 miles south and west of the Gardner Cabin, this tiny hamlet tucked in the hills above the Little Sioux River also suffers the cruel winter. Since December, that suffering has been shared with a small band of familiar Dakotas camped nearby. Their leader, Ink Vedute, tolerates a testy relationship with the white man. Memories of the Henry Lot Sitamondota incident still fester in the back of his mind, while the Little Sioux Valley occupies a very special place in his heart, the ancestral winter hunting ground of his people. Once teeming with deer, elk, and small game, but not this year. And then the next page, I just decided to, which I love doing, insert a couple of verses of a poem from the Song of Hiawatha by Longfellow. Oh, the wasting of the famine, oh, the wailing of the children, oh, the anguish of the women, all the earth was sick and famished. Hungry was the air around them, hungry was the sky above them, and the hungry stars in heaven, like the eyes of wolves, glared at them. Now that's Longfellow talking about enemies of the Native Americans in the Song of Hiawatha. And the next page in, I'm on to my own words, not quite as amazing as Longfellow's.
Well,
but,
not as poetic, perhaps.
Yeah, but early onset extreme weather has compromised the wildlife population as well as the crops planted by Smithland farmers. It has also reduced proud Dakotas to hungry beggars and petty thieves, stoking resentment among entitled whites. a Dakota hunter is attacked by the settler's dog. He kills the cur in self-defense. The settler retaliates, brutally beating the Dakota and taking his gun. Smithland hunters lay claim to deer tracked and shot by Dakotas. Farmers whip Dakota women, scavenging frozen cornfields. Inkpaduta's men counter, shooting settlers' cattle. Smithland responds with a company of vigilantes organized by a bombastic ex-Ohio militiaman, Seth Smith. They march on the Dakota camp, delivering an ultimatum. And then I insert my own words. Well, these are all my own words, but I insert the conversation as a graphic novel with blurbs from the different people talking. You must relinquish all firearms and leave our valley now. And then Inkpaduta responds, your valley? My people have hunted this valley since the beginning of time. And then the white man says, but time marches on, and the time has come for you and your sorry lot to be gone. And then Inkpaduta responds, if we go, we keep our guns. Without guns, we cannot survive the winter. And then the white man finishes the conversation by saying, I repeat, no guns. And then the final page of Smithland, the chapter, is a dark cloud settles over Inkpaduta as he watches the Wasichu militia ransack his defenseless village, confiscating firearms. By the way, Wasichu is the Dakota word for white man. Angry Dakotas collect the scattered remains of their campsite and a few guns quietly procured from local sympathizers. So now this is my words right now would say, so there were some white people in Smithland that supported the Dakotas, but not very many. And head northward up the Little Sioux Valley toward the Okoboges and Spirit Lake. You turn the page in the book. The next page says March 1857, the moon of the snow blind, and that's the darkest chapter of the book, probably. So there we are. That's Smithland. And again, I was really fascinated by the fact that it had a really impact on this story, and I'd never heard of it, of that part of the story over all those years.
And that was Gary Kelly reading from Moon of the Snowblind. It's probably, most of the stories that we've heard have probably been more from the settler's perspective. And
sure. Oh, absolutely.
So
oh,
giving, telling that part of the story would be almost a justification for what happened.
Yeah, if there is such a thing. That's why I said two sides to every story at the opening of the book, because there are dark sides by both cultures, really.
Right.
I'm not saying that everything Inkpaduta and his people done was okay, justified. It wasn't. But what had happened to them was not justified either, if you're a reasonable person. So that's kind of what I wanted to remind the reader, that there are two sides to this story, by the way. And I think a lot of people that sort of know the story, a lot of Iowans, I suppose, don't really realize that.
Oh, I'm sure. I'll tell you, something interested me was the white shirts, the men who came and, tried to bargain to get the young girls that had been taken as captives and get them released. And it was interesting that they were not attacked by the Indians. They were accepted as, okay, we're going to do this. I thought that was interesting. I really did.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. That's part of the, what I think what started this part of the conversation that appeals to me is finding information that I can put right down notes or just remember and then go to the drawing board and try and figure out a way to put it together as a visual story. I mean, there's some things that just don't work that way, but I knew when I started this book that I had to finish it because there's a lot of visual potential. And
because
I finished it in Yeah, I finished it in 184 pages. That's all it took.
Because the white shirts were Indians, too. I mean, you know, that was interesting to me. It really was. That they were, you know.
How long did you work on this project? It sounds like it might have been quite a long time.
To tell you the truth, I don't remember the year I started it. not because it, because I have a lot of assignments usually, and I enjoy most of them, and so it's off and on. But I would say probably 6 years, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I'd say 6 or 7 years. I knew I wanted to do it as a graphic novel. I hadn't really done a serious graphic novel before that. And I'd done little short, you know, zines and little, you know, 8-pagers or things like that. But I didn't want to give up on this. And I was pretty amazed at myself that I didn't, because I have started other stories and never gotten nearly this close to being done.
It is interesting that it seems like graphic novels are kind of a new thing in publishing, although not really new. And I remember back in when I was a child, and this is a long time ago, so we're talking back in the 60s, having, do you ever hear of Classic Comics?
Oh, yeah, I used to buy those. I even though they cost 15 cents, that's a nickel more than a regular comic.
Oh, yeah. Well, Mom bought them for us, and that was how I got a lot of my classic literary educational the founding of knowledge about some of the great books, because...
Oh, me too. I had some of those, too.
Yeah, Wuthering Heights or Lord Jim or, you know, all kinds of different, some Charles Dickens probably. I wish I knew where those were now.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly which ones I had, but I do remember the one thing about classics, classic comics back in those days was that a lot of times I wasn't as big a fan of the way they were drawn as I was of some other, you know, the other comics that were, you know, I mean, I liked Red Rider, you know, and Little Beaver, that the cowboy stuff, and then G.I. Joe and that kind of stuff. That's the kind of stuff that, not that I was an aggressive, you know, fighter or anything like that. That's not why I liked them. I just thought the stories were visually maybe probably more interesting to tell for a young guy like me than you know, Little Women or something.
Yeah. Now,
those stories at all, but yeah.
Do they even have comic books anymore? Is there such a thing?
Pardon?
Is there such a thing as comic books anymore?
I think there must be. I mean, there's a store here in Cedar Falls called The Core that has... is full of comics and graphic novels, and they're still out there. You can still buy them, but I've never bought, you know, it's been a long time since I bought a Superman or, you know, a Batman comic or anything. I mean, that's interestingly enough on that subject. Now, I don't know if your listeners, a lot of them have ever heard of or read of the graphic stories called Hellboy. And they are it's an iconic comic or graphic novel in this culture today. And it's called Hellboy, and it's written and drawn by a guy named Mike Mignola, who lives in L.A., where my daughter near where my daughter lived, and he wanted to meet me when he'd seen my work in other places, not in graphic novels, but he just wanted to get together and have lunch one day, and so we did, and now we're friends, that we're connected, we you know, and he is, if you look him up in that in that category, you know, of whether it's graphic novels or whatever. He is a classic writer illustrator of comics today. His name is Mike Mignola, Mignola, and he was happy to. I sent him the, you know, he's got a copy of the Moon of the Snowblind, and he's an icon. I mean, for people that read those kind of books nowadays, they all know who he is.
So most of the illustrations that you do, are they for picture books?
No, it's a wide variety. Right now, I came home early so I could talk to you from the studio today. But I've been working today and probably maybe finish it tomorrow or the next day on a very tight sketch or colored drawing, totally colored detailed drawing for a mural in Cedar Rapids for the New Bohemia neighborhood down there. And they wanted something that dealt with the history of the Bohemian history that as it was and how it came to Cedar Rapids and, you know, and influenced their culture. And so the thing that really has addicted me to that project is the fact that they let me do it the way I wanted to. And I didn't want to do it like a Grant Wood or a Thomas Hart Benton, you know, Midwestern artist painting on a wall. I wanted to do it like Bohemian art from the time when all these Bohemians came to Iowa, you know, in the early 1900s. And I love that style of art because there's a lot of line work and it's pretty graphic. And so that's the way I'm doing it. And they were happy to have me. I could do what I wanted. And I'm just telling a little bit of the Bohemian history of Cedar Rapids now in one big 70-foot picture. So.
Oh, well. Now, that's Bohemian as in from the western part of the Czech Republic, not Bohemian
right.
as far as, like, someone who lives an unconventional lifestyle.
No. That's what this is. The origin of Bohemia, I guess. But that's a good point because that's a lot of what really attracts me to projects is doing that kind of research and figuring out, okay, now I probably have 1,000 books in my studio. I probably got a book there that I can find. I can look up a map and because I don't have a computer in my studio and I can look it up and figure out what part of Europe Bohemia was considered. And then I realized that there were a lot of artists from that era and that part of Europe that I have totally been fascinated by, whether it's Alfons Mucha or Gustav Klimt or Egon Schiele, a lot of those artists, and I'd love the kind of graphic way some of them worked, and I thought, I'm going to do this. This will be way more fun for me if they let me do it this way. And after they commissioned me to do it, and they did, and I'm having a blast. You know, I'll be sorry when I'm done because it's too much fun.
What is that artistic style like?
Well, it's not that much unlike a graphic novel in a lot of cases because there's line work and then really rich color under the line work, and the colors are fairly flat. You know, they're not real rendered. Like I said, if it was a Thomas Hart Benton painting or something, or a Grant Wood painting, because it's Midwestern, you'd see a lot more of a rendered kind of shape of a figure. But the artists like these guys in Czechoslovakia and Austria and that part of Europe back 100 years ago or so, they were doing, they did a lot of lithographs and printmaking and then some painting too, obviously, but line work was important to them. And that's why I thought it's going to be a fun mural to design and do. I don't have to paint it. I just have to turn it over to the painter, but, that style is a little bit more like what a graphic novel, a quality graphic novel would look like, I think.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, I'm actually working on another graphic novel right now. I mean, off and on when I have time, because these are self-promotion. These are for me. I have no budget to do them, but I'm working on one right now that is sort of based a little bit on that style, and it's called Bach and the Blues. It's about music, and Pablo Casals, you know, the iconic cello master, who recorded the Bach cello suites, which are classics, the same week in history when Robert Johnson, the king of the Delta Blues from Mississippi, recorded his iconic album in a hotel room in San Antonio. Casals recorded his at Abbey Road Studios in London, which of course all Beatles fans know about, and again Robert Johnson recorded his in a hotel room in San Antonio, and both those stories have a lot of drama beside the music. They both had tough times with their lives. You know, Robert Johnson living in the American South in the 1930s, of course, that was not good for him. And Pablo Casals was a Spanish icon, but he had to deal with Hitler, Mussolini, and fascism during that part of his career. And I just thought those two stories have so much drama, and we can bring them together at the end of the graphic novel with this week in history when they both recorded their iconic albums.
That's really fascinating that you would put those two together like that.
Well, I got hooked on that story, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, 6, 7 years ago, because I listened to Iowa Public Radio, NPR, all the time. And they did a feature on that in November, the same week that was the 75th anniversary, I think, of when this week was that Pablo and Robert kind of came together. They never knew each other, but they came together and recorded.
So what was the Harlem Hellfighters?
That was my idea to do that book. And it's a picture book. It's not a graphic novel, but there are a lot of pictures in it. I mean, it's not just a typical children's book, you know, where you turn the page, there's one picture, turn the page, there's another. Some pages have a number of pictures with borders or drawn. You know, it's, that idea, I was fascinated by because the Harlem Hellfighters were an African American group of musicians who went to and fought in World War I in Germany. And so it was just an amazing story to tell because they had that was their group of soldiers for us in World War I. And I love that. It was my idea to do it. I pitched it to the publisher, Creative Editions, who are wonderful people to work with, and they said, yeah, go ahead, let's do it. And so I just love telling stories like that visually. Like I said earlier, you know, telling a story like the Harlem Hellfighters visually is just really amazing because I love the fact that those African Americans were jazz and blues guys from New York City, from Harlem, back in the 1910-1915 period, and they all ended up going to Europe to fight and to play American music, you know, in the military music, and so that's the story. I mean, there was two things. I love history, and I love that that music. So it all came together for a book, and I thought, oh, this is, I've got to pitch this to them and hope they buy it, and they did.
And then you collaborated with a writer on that one?
Yeah. I pitched the writer to Patrick Lewis, J. Patrick Lewis. He's written a lot of classics for Creative Editions and publishers, and we've done books together. I love working with Patrick, and he lives in Ohio. And I'd done a few books with him, and I thought, I love this story. I'm gonna pitch it to Patrick and see if he'll write it. And he did. And you know, like the bio said, we were one of the finalists for the New York Times Picture Book of the Year that year when that book came out. So.
Yeah, I got an idea for a book for you, the Indian Code Talkers in the Second World War.
Yeah, what about it?
Well, wouldn't that be a good story?
I've already done it.
Oh, we've already. Okay.
That's ironic. That's why I asked you, because ironically, I followed up the Hellfighters with Patrick Lewis to do the Code Talkers.
Okay. I mean, I've been fascinated by that. You know, that was...
Well, I suppose if you Google that title by Patrick Lewis and Gary Kelly, you can track that book down.
Okay.
It was great fun. No, it was my idea to do it, and Patrick was ready to jump on board, I enjoyed that project.
The Navajo Code Talkers.
Yep.
Yep. I just Googled
yep.
it.
Yep.
Yeah, well,
Patrick's
they were
a great
very,
writer
very
and
instrumental in helping us.
Easy to work with, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's ironic. You have good taste.
Yeah,
I should say so.
So, do you have any books other than you did talk about the one that you're working on now? Do you have any others in the works?
Well, the graphic novel, yeah, Bach and the Blues.
Yeah, Bach and
but
the Blues.
That's me. That's, I don't have a publisher that assigned it. I'm doing it for me, like the Moon of the Snowblind. So we'll get it out there, I think. But, there's one I just finished within the last, I don't know, a few months ago that's called Songs for the Cosmos. And it's about Blind Willie Johnson, who was an African American blues man, it was already written. The book was written. It wasn't Patrick Lewis that wrote it, but same publisher. And it was already written. And they sent me the manuscript. Creative Editions did. And usually they know what I want to do, what'll get me excited. And they figured this would, and they were right. And it's a story about a blind African American that recorded some iconic blues back in the early 1900s and 1920s and 30s. And I don't remember the details of this part of the story because I wasn't that it's not that visual, but his music was one. Was the American or the music that they put on a spaceship or a rocket ship, you know, a satellite, whatever it was, that was put into outer space with American culture in containers. there were no people. There were no people on board, but they wanted to, in case it landed on another planet. That's a true story. It's a true story, and his story is true as well. And so that one should be out any time now. I haven't seen the printed version yet, but and then Virginia Was a Spy. I did that one a couple years ago for them as well, and that was about the woman that lost her. Leg shot herself in the foot in the leg when she was a young girl and ended up moving to Europe so she could help bring down the Nazis World War II.
And it's
a fascinating story. That's the great thing about working with somebody like Creative Editions. They know the kind of stories that I want to read and then tell visually. So that's what they pitch to me, and I always jump on right away.
Very cool. Well, Gary, this has been a lot of fun, but we're out of time.
I didn't think it would seem like it happened so fast.
I know.
I appreciate it.
Mom, do you have a quote for us?
Well, actually, it's a quote, the first thing in the book. There are two sides to every story. And, you know, that's something we should really remember, because although when you're involved in something, you think your side is the side, but there really are two sides to every story.
Right. Yep. And I thought that's a really cliche of a comment, that term, mm-hmm. two sides to every story, but I thought that is the perfect way to make people think about Moon of the Snowblind, I think.
Right.
I think so too. Well, thank you, Gary, for being with us today.
Well, thank you. Thank both of you, and I appreciate it. I got through this a lot easier than I thought it would.
Oh, you did great.
Oh, well. Thanks to you guys.
And we'll see you all next week on Writers' Voices.